This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The story my guest Kelly Kennedy tells is one that I haven't heard before about Iraq. It's been described as a mutiny. It's the story of a platoon in the hardest-hit battalion since Vietnam and why they decided they could no longer fulfill their mission in the surge. They were tired and angry at the insurgents, insurgents who paid children to throw grenades at the soldiers. The men in the platoon were so tired and angry, they were afraid if they returned to patrolling the streets, they'd lose control and murder civilians. Kennedy was embedded with these men, the 2nd Platoon, Charlie Company, 126, in June 2007. She was with them on their worst day, and on the day a first sergeant committed suicide in front of his men. The platoon was in Ahmadiyya, one of the most violent neighborhoods in Baghdad. Kelly's new book is called They Fought for Each Other, The Triumph and Tragedy of the Hardest-Hit Unit in Iraq. Kennedy covers health and medical issues for the Army Times, which is published by Gannett, not the military. She served in the Army from 1987 to 93, including tours in the Gulf War and Mogadishu. Kelly Kennedy, welcome to Fresh Air. One of the more dramatic incidents you write about was when a 19-year-old, Ross McGinnis, threw himself on a grenade to save four friends. Would you describe what happened?
Sure. Ross McGinnis was 19 years old. He had big brown eyes and this huge grin, and he was silly, just kept the guys in giggles all the time. And about a week before December 4th, they'd been out on patrol, and someone threw a grenade into a truck, and everyone jumped out, and it turned out to be a dud, so everyone was safe. And then Ross kind of made jokes about it, like, no way, man, I'd be jumping out. I'd be the first one out of the truck. And so they spent the next week kind of practicing, you know, throwing tennis balls into the trucks and then diving out. And then on December 4th, they're out on patrol, and the grenade came right in through Ross's turret. And he was the gunner. And he sees it. He tries to catch it. He's chasing it around the turret, and he's yelling grenade, trying to get the guys out of the truck. And no one really understood what was happening, and they didn't have time to react, but Ross knew what was going on. So he chased it all the way back down into the truck, and then one of the other guys, Ian Newland, saw the grenade and watched as Ross McGinnis threw himself against it and took the brunt of the force of the grenade and died instantly, but saved four of his friends. And that was really interesting to me because you hear hero stories like that, but you don't necessarily hear how that affects the men he's with. So they're so grateful for what he did, but also always trying to figure out how they could have saved him.
And one man in particular, Ian Newland, thought that he could have done more to save McGinnis. Ian Newland thought that he should have died too. What impact did that have on him?
This is fairly common in combat stress that these guys feel guilt over over things that there's no way they could have changed. That Newland didn't have time to do anything to fix that situation. So he feels like every single day he has to live up to this gift that McGinnis gave him. And I think he's coming to terms with that now. He's working on opening a horse ranch in Colorado to try to help wounded veterans or veterans dealing with PTSD or post-traumatic stress disorder. But I think it's something that he deals with every day and probably once an hour, just trying to embrace what his friend did for him, but then also live up to it.
Now, you mentioned that, among other things, after the grenade, he had traumatic brain injury. And that's a pretty common injury now in Iraq and probably in Afghanistan, too, because of the IEDs. I think if you are in a vehicle that is hit or close to a vehicle that is hit by an IED, the aftershock of that can cause a concussion or a traumatic brain injury. Would you describe how frequently you think men in the company that you were following ended up with traumatic brain injury, whether it was diagnosed or not?
Sure. There's varying degrees of a traumatic brain injury. In the civilian world, we've always called them concussions. You know, it's, you know, football injury is a concussion. So these guys were generally dealing with mild traumatic brain injuries. But even a mild traumatic brain injury can cause short-term memory loss, really bad headaches, confusion in the anger issues. Some of the guys actually end up with epilepsy, with seizures. And these guys, every single one of them had been involved in some sort of a blast. And the blast wave actually travels through the brain, well, through your whole body. And they're still sort of studying how that affects you. If this blast wave is going through blood, then tissue, then bone, how does that affect it? But there were guys who were saying they were hit in as many as 15 times. And it was important for them. They felt like it was important for them to always go out with their guys. So they'd sort of try to scoot through on the testing afterward. The medics would do tests to see if they'd been injured, if there had been a traumatic brain injury. And part of the test was a memory test, you know, look at these three words and then recite them back to me. But the guys memorized all the words ahead of time so that they could keep going out on patrol. So diagnosing it was difficult anyway.
So were there men in the company that you were following who were diagnosed with TBI?
Not while I was there. I mean, several of them had concussions and their medics knew that they had concussions. In one case, one of the soldiers came back and even having memorized that test, he couldn't recite the words back. It was that bad. So they took him off for a while. He stayed behind for the patrols while he was recovering for that.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Kelly Kennedy. She's a reporter for the Army Times, and she has a new book called They Fought for Each Other, The Triumph and Tragedy of the Hardest Hit Unit in Iraq. She embedded with this unit in June of 2007. You were with the company you were embedded with on their worst day. This was in June 21st of 2007. What made that day the worst day?
Yeah, we spent a couple of days with them. I'd gone out with that unit in particular because I'd heard they had a really amazing group of medics, and I wanted to do a story about that. And I was also reporting on combat stress, and I knew they'd been hit pretty hard. So we went on patrols with them. Every patrol we went on, there was another roadside bomb or an IED. And, I mean, usually they'd find them and blow them up, but I think they were all scared already because they knew that there were more bombs out there. So on the morning of June 21st, we went out on patrol with them, and then they went out again. And the photographer, Rick Kozak, and I decided to stay back and do some interviews while they went out on that second patrol. And we were actually sitting out on some picnic tables talking to the guys about combat stress when we heard an explosion. And what had happened was a Bradley, a 30-ton vehicle, had rolled over a massive deep buried bomb, and it was so big that it flipped the Bradley over and left a hole the size of a Humvee in the road. And an Iraqi interpreter and four of the guys died instantly, and then a fifth guy was caught underneath the Bradley and couldn't get away as it was burning. And back at the aid station, all the guys knew was that This Bradley had been hit. They didn't know who was in it. They didn't know how bad it was. They knew it was on fire and that the guys were trapped inside, but they weren't hearing any more information than that. We sat there for about an hour just waiting. It was the worst hour ever, waiting to hear what had happened. And then one of the guys heard over the radio that they'd all died. And then as another unit, the 630th MPs were responding to June 21st to that Bradley explosion. One of their female MPs was hit by a rocket-propelled grenade, and it decapitated her in front of four of her teammates in a Humvee. And then their chaplain was coming out to assist, and as he was driving out, they ran over yet another IED in a Humvee. And the driver's legs were pretty messed up after that, and Chaplain Choi ended up with some pretty bad bruising. And so they finally get back in, and everyone's dealing with that, and the battalion commander comes out, Colonel Eric Schacht, and as they're preparing the body bags and taking care of the guys, they notified the colonel that he needed to go back to the main base, where they told him that his son had died that day. He had a 13-year-old son who had a heart condition, and he died. So, I mean, the day just kept getting worse and worse and worse. to the point where you wonder how anyone could deal with it. It was horrifying.
Well, the men in the platoon were wondering how they could deal with it. They were. Why don't you just describe the range of emotional reactions you observed among the survivors in this platoon?
Sure. You know, it was all over the place the way they reacted. And there's a soldier named Gary Dinardi who was trying to get out of the gate. You know, he's standing at the gate trying to run out into the street to help people, and the guards were actually holding him back, and he threw a water bottle and was sort of stomping around. There's another guy, Eric Osterman, who very calmly started spreading water down on the sand to try to keep the dust down, and making sure other people had water to hydrate. It was really hot that day. The medics were very calmly going about setting up the aid station, and they didn't know how many people they'd be bringing in. A lot of guys just sitting down with their heads in their hands and distraught and waiting. And there was one soldier who was actually really upset that the media were there on that day.
The media, meaning you and your photographer.
Exactly. They had dealt with so many reporters in the past and generally did pretty well with it. But that day was so personal to them, and they were so upset about coverage in general that, you know, their friends would die and it would come up as a number on the news and no one would know who those guys really were. And they just wanted people to know who their friends were, who they'd lost. And I think they were afraid that we were going to go back and do this sensationalistic story and use it in a political way. That was their other complaint, was that their stories were often used to show that the surge wasn't working, and they didn't want it to be political. So one of the soldiers, we were asked to go inside after a while. They're like, the soldiers need to calm down, so can you go inside for a minute? And Rick and I had both been sort of standing way back. I mean, we understood what had happened, and we understood that to do the reporting and the photography that day, we didn't need to be on top of them, didn't need to make that day any worse. And I found out later on, we went to Germany when they came home, and one of the guys, we'd been drinking beer and hanging out all night, and he started crying and told me that he locked and loaded on me that day, that he was so angry that he'd considered shooting me, and the guys pulled him back. And he's someone I hear from all the time now. He's a good kid. But the moment was so traumatizing for him. He needed to take his anger out somewhere. And I was sort of the target of that. So,
now, one of the men shot himself not long after this worst day.
Right.
Tell us his story.
His name was First Sergeant Jeff McKinney. And he was known for singing on patrol Sesame Street songs, and pretty squared away. The other first sergeants in the unit would go to him if they needed help with something, they needed to learn something. He had a new wife and a new baby, and he was talking about retirement and was all excited about that. But he was also really stressing out over not being able to take care of his men as well as he wanted to. He felt like they weren't getting the food and the water they needed. So he'd do things like not drink or not eat, and he wouldn't sleep because he felt like he needed to be taking care of his guys constantly. And I think the combination of those things, along with he was with First Sergeant Kenny Hendricks on June 21st when they recovered the body, so he'd seen some really bad things too. And he wasn't sleeping. He was acting strangely. His guys were noticing it. And one day they went out on patrol, and he stepped out of the Humvee, and he put his M4 under his chin and pulled the trigger in front of his men. And one of the guys who saw it in the medical records actually confirmed this, said that at the last minute he sort of twitched his head to the side as if he realized what he was doing and didn't want to. It seems to have been a instant, not thought out thing. It wasn't like he was planning it, and he hadn't been suicidal in the past. That's how his stress sort of erupted for him that day. And the interesting thing about it was the other first sergeants, after it happened, wondered if they were close to the same. They didn't look at it as, you know, he's weak, or we don't understand why he did this. they saw it as this is a bad place and we're going through a lot and I need to take better care of myself and my men.
Well, shortly after the suicide and after the worst day for this platoon, they thought that they couldn't go out anymore, that they just kind of hit a wall.
Right.
And although you are no longer embedded with the platoon, you write about this. So I'm sure they must have told you in detail what happened, yes?
Yes.
Yeah, so you describe that the whole platoon marched as a group to the mental health clinic. What did they have to say?
Well, soon after McKinney's suicide, they'd been told to go out on patrol, and they said, that road's black. There's bombs on that road. We know that we're not supposed to go on that road. And because of the weather, they couldn't get back out to Apache during a sandstorm or something. That mission for them got canceled, and they sent out another company instead. And those guys went out in their 30-ton Bradley and hit another deep-buried IED, and June 21st happened all over again. And these guys were in a different company, but they were friends still. They were guys they knew, and it felt like for the guys, like their leadership had let them down, had let them die. So they went to mental health and they said, if we go out on patrol in Adamia, we're going to kill everyone in our paths. We're so angry that we cannot function with any kind of ethical code at this point. And the therapist, the mental health counselor said, you know, at some point you need to stand down. If you guys think that you're going to make bad decisions and do things that are going to ruin your lives and others, then you need to stand down.
Okay, so you have this whole platoon that decides they can't go out again. They're even afraid that they're going to end up killing civilians and going to jail for it because they're that angry. They truly feel like they cannot contain their anger anymore. So what did their leadership have to say? I mean, the mental health experts agreed these men shouldn't go out. What did the leadership have to say?
Well, the leadership was, there was definitely a lack of communication. The company commander didn't know about the trip to the mental health clinic, and he didn't know about the medications they were on.
Was he new?
He was fairly new. Yeah. He'd come in the spring, and this was in the summer. But their platoon sergeant apparently hadn't relayed the message, and the platoon sergeant, who was also a former drill instructor, felt like they should be obeying the order. You know, even though he'd said in the past that it was time for 2nd Platoon to stand back, he wanted them to go out that day. There was some talk about how it wasn't fair for 2nd Platoon to stand back because that just meant someone else had to go out in their place. But then the company commander actually came out later and said, I was disappointed that they didn't follow my order. That's their job. That's the military mission. But I respect them for what they did. I respect them for understanding where they were at in that moment and for not going out that day.
So in the long run, they weren't seen as either selfish or cowardly, but as kind of accurately representing their state of mind and thinking that their state of mind was an inappropriate state of mind to go out on a military mission.
Right. Ultimately, they were eventually seen as courageous for that decision.
Was it considered a mutiny?
You know, that's a word that some people in the battalion used. So I don't think it was considered a full-on mutiny once people understood the background to it. But they definitely refused to follow an order, and it was known within the battalion as the 2nd Platoon mutiny.
So just to make sure I understand correctly, so when the platoon decided they couldn't go out and the mental health expert said you shouldn't be going out, but then the command said, no, you need to go out, the platoon still did not go out.
Right.
And so what was the immediate punishment and what was the end of the story?
They were administratively flagged, which meant that they couldn't get awards or promotions or go on leave or anything like that. And that lasted for about 2 months. And then the company commander said, I think that's enough. They pulled the sergeants out of the platoon and gave them new leadership, which the guy saw as punishment, but the first sergeant and the company commander saw as a way to sort of get them back in a fighting mode again, and they still had to cover their battle space even with this platoon had sort of broken in the middle of the mission. So
how much more time did they have after this a mutiny.
About 3 months after the mutiny, they went home.
And did they all survive? Did everybody in this platoon who refused to follow orders survive the remaining 3 months?
They did. Throughout their tour, that platoon had lost 9 men. A platoon's about 40 guys. But from that moment on, everyone was okay. There was one more injury after that. It was a medic who was out on patrol and was shot, Tyler Holliday. But he lived. He was okay.
What impact did that day have on you? Did you feel like you ended up with post-traumatic stress disorder?
Well, post-traumatic stress disorder is, there's a full range of symptoms you have to have, but people call some of those symptoms that people generalize sort of as PTSD. When I got home, I was blowing through stop signs. I just didn't see them. I would get up in the morning to read the paper, and it would take me 3 hours. I was just very distracted. And I was sad. For about a year, I think I was in a mild depression. So I'd say sort of some anxiety issues for me. Nothing like what the guys are dealing with, the nightmares and the flashbacks and that sort of thing. And I mean, I didn't have any of the guilt kind of stuff to deal with. But it definitely helped me understand a little bit about how something like that can affect your brain and your outlook on the whole world as opposed to just what happened that day.
Well, what about the men after returning? You kept up with them. Did most of them suffer from nightmares and flashbacks and anxieties of various sorts as a result of their experiences in Iraq?
I wouldn't say most of them. I'd say a lot of them. It sounds like all of the medics are dealing with some things. A lot of the guys had nightmares. I wouldn't say all of them have full-blown post-traumatic stress, but I'm definitely hearing about guys who are leaving the military now. With disability benefits because they're not able to function as well anymore. I think the rate in general is something like 20% for combat stress or post-traumatic stress disorder symptoms.
One of the people you thank in your acknowledgments is one of the medics from the platoon that you were embedded with, Tyler Holliday. You thank him for making you feel like part of the group, not just a reporter looking for a scoop. You write a lot about the stresses of being a medic. In Iraq, especially, you know, with that platoon anyways. And you say that the medics in that platoon were taking on the men's psychological as well as physical problems, treating them for psychological issues. And they were just absorbing all of these problems and not having anybody to go to themselves. Now, he was very seriously injured. What happened to this medic?
Tyler was out on patrol, and they were looking at abandoned vehicles and trying to get rid of them. They were calling in to have someone come pick them up. And as he was coming back from one of the vehicles, he got hit by a sniper in the stomach. And I mean, the stomach wound is something that the guys fear more than just about anything because it's hard to address immediately as a medic. And for Tyler, it was terrifying because he was the medic. There wasn't another medic with him. So he'd done some training with his guys to try to help them if they were in a situation like that or in case of a large amount of casualties where he couldn't do everything himself. But all the medics talk about how that first injury is the most difficult one to treat. So he's surrounded by guys who haven't necessarily done it before and giving them instructions. You need to do this. You need to use a wet bandage, not a dry bandage, and he could feel his stomach filling with fluids. And as he's telling these guys what to do, he's certain he's going to die, and he's telling them to tell the other medics that he loves them, and he's just sure he's done. And it turned out that if he'd had an appendix, he would have been. It would have killed him, but because his appendix had been removed, the bullet didn't actually hit anything that he needed immediately, and they were able to save him.
Tell us a little bit about some of the stresses that the medics in the platoon you were embedded with had to deal with. Why was it so stressful for them, and how were their stresses different than the stresses of the other men in the platoon?
The infantry tends to be a little macho, so one of the things they know can help for combat stress is to talk about it. But if you're a tough guy, it's really hard to talk to your buddy about it. So the medics, who were not in their chain of command, were sort of a neutral, sort of a safe place to go talk. And they knew that if they told the medics, they weren't going to go talking about it to anybody else. So someone would be having nightmares, and Doc Holliday would listen to the stories about the nightmares and try to get the person back on track. Or someone would have a really bad day, you know, see another dead body on the street for a while. They were picking up 10 bodies a day and need someone to sort of talk it out with what he'd seen. And Doc Holliday would listen. And then when they did get casualties, he was not only treating the guys, but if they died, he was the one who was identifying the bodies and loading them in the body bags. So it wasn't just that he was dealing with injured men. He was dealing with his injured men. He was dealing with these guys who told them, you know, their fears and their hopes and their friends. They're the guys that they drank beer with back home. And I think it's a whole different thing for a medic in the military as opposed to, you know, a regular doctor.
Why did you join the military back in, was it 89?
Yeah, I joined the National Guard when I was in high school. That was 87, and joined the regular Army in 89. And it was to get money for school. It was 1987, and there hadn't been a war for a very long time. And I wanted to pay for my college, and it seemed like it'd be an adventure. So I joined the military.
Maybe a bigger adventure than you thought, because there was a war, the Gulf War.
Right, in Somalia, too. I ended up over there.
Oh, okay. So how did it feel to be a young woman who signed up in the hopes of, you know, some adventure, getting some money for college, and suddenly you're basically in two war zones?
It scared the heck out of me. It really forced me to think about what I believed in personally. And I remember in Desert Storm, I was reading accounts of how soldiers were being forced to fight for Saddam Hussein. So even if they didn't want to be involved in that war or believe in what he was doing, they were being forced to fight. And I remember thinking, oh my gosh, how could I hurt somebody like that? How could I shoot back? And that being a big issue for me. And then I remember going to Mogadishu and having guys in my unit attacked, or there was a Marine who was killed. He was knifed really close to where we were set up, and being so angry that I felt like I could shoot back. And having that knowledge without having the background knowledge to understand what the people there might be thinking about a bunch of Americans showing up. I think I learned a lot about myself in that way that I wasn't expecting to learn.
Well, Kelly Kennedy, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Kelly Kennedy is the author of the new book, They Fought for Each Other, The Triumph and Tragedy of the Hardest Hit Unit in Iraq. She covers health and medical issues for the Army Times. You can read the first chapter of her book and find a link to her PTSD series on our website, freshair.npr.org. The novelist and short story writer Barry Hanna died of a heart attack Monday. He was 67. We're going to listen back to an excerpt of the interview I recorded with him. Larry McMurtry called Hanna the best fiction writer to appear in the South since Flannery O'Connor. William Styron described Hanna as an original, one of the most consistently exciting writers of the post-Faulkner generation. Hanna wrote about the American South. He grew up in Mississippi and taught for many years at the University of Mississippi. He won the William Faulkner Prize and was a National Book Award finalist. When I spoke with him in July 2001, his book Yonder Stands Your Orphan had just been published. The title borrowed a line from the Dylan song, It's All Over Now, Baby Blue. There are orphans and guns in the novel and plenty of evil as a killer changes the lives of everyone around him. Hanna wrote the book while getting chemotherapy treatments for lymphoma. Here's Hanna introducing a short reading from the book.
This is Man Mortimer, who is the evil that lurks in this book, and he likes to cut people. He comes from Missouri, and there's a little piece about him. At this juncture, he had no plans to hurt people around the lake. He did not like bodies of water much, had never seen the ocean. He was indifferent to trees. Soil was hateful to him, as was the odor of fish. But like many another man, 45 years in age, he wanted his youth back. He wanted to have pals, sports, high school girls. This need had rushed on him lately. He lived in three houses, but he had no home. He did not like the hearth, smells from the kitchen, an old friend for a wife, small talk. It all seemed a vicious closet to him. He moved, he took, he was admired. But he had developed a taste for young and younger flesh. This was thrilling and meant high money. Men and women in this nation were changing, and he intended to charge them for it. Religion had neither formed nor harmed him. Neither had his parents in southern Missouri. But he despised the weakness of the church and of his parents, whom he had gulled. He was a pretty boy born of hawk-nosed people. It was a curse to have these looks and no talent. Long, lank, hooded eyes, sensual lips that sang no tune. Still, he quit the football team because of what it did to his hair, claiming a back ailment that had exempted him from manual labor since age 14. There are thousands of men of this condition, most of them sorry and shiftless, defeated at the start. Many are compulsives and snarling fools, demeritus at 20.
Is this character of Man Mortimer based on anyone?
No, he's not. He's a compound, and I've gotten, just by looking around and believing that I perceived evil in front of me. So it is imaginative, but a collected history of my impressions, I believe.
You describe him as a quiet man, a gambler, a liaison for stolen cars, and a runner of whores, including three Vicksburg housewives. Describe his kind of crime.
His kind of crime is a kind of crime that begins out of laziness and being admired by women. He finds he can make a living at it, and he continues since he ran away from home in high school. He's not been particularly violent, but he has induced violent suicides in others. He is a thief. He has a stolen car ring, especially expensive SUVs. He's a man who doesn't like to work, and he doesn't like much of what's offered by nature. So I feel him as an alien without real pals, and only a commercial connection to women. He wants to join in society now, but he only knows how to hurt. And that's the base of the book. Evil, when it reaches out to you and when it befriends you. And in Mortimer's case, he likes to use a knife. He's dangerous, and he has made quite a bit deal of money off the casino life around Vicksburg.
Has evil like Man Mortimer's kind of evil ever come into your life?
I've been around it. Usually evil is something you can't face. It simply has to wear out. Sometimes you work for evil unwittingly. And I can't think of a particular person right now. But I think I've felt the closeness of evil in casinos, and it brings out the old Baptist in me. I find the wretched excess and the sort of zombified folks that attend and participate in casinos pathetic and also dangerous in many cases.
And what about violence? There's some violence in this book. Has violence come into your life? Have you witnessed it? Have you ever had a violent streak yourself?
I like to throw knives back in my drinking days, but no, I've never been personally violent. I can't be an honest man, though, and tell you, but that I am occupied by violence. It seems to be out of my nightmares. And my wife wishes I wouldn't write about violence, but as soon as the pen starts going, I become interested in it all over again. And it's as if it's almost dictated to me, because I've been writing for 35 years, and it's attended a good deal of my work. At this point, I don't think I can do anything but confess that I am a student of violence because of what it does, because of how it quickens the character of those around it.
You've also collected guns, right?
I've collected guns, yes.
And have you used them? What kind of things do you use them for?
I have not used a gun in 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
If I used them right now, I'd shoot beer cans at the city dump. It's a 22 rifle. Now, I don't have any real personal urge to shoot anymore. It just passed. And I've never shot at a human being, never threatened a human being. If that's covering the subject.
So what did you use the guns for?
You know, this is a difficult thing to explain to others about how a gun is a piece of art. Guns are history. I like to look at the mechanism. I like to feel the heft. And they are a kind of history. So that's about all I can say. I don't collect guns anymore, but I'm not sorry for the ones I have. They just feel like a decent hunk of the past hanging on the wall.
Describe where you grew up.
I grew up in Clinton, Mississippi, which is right outside the state capital in Jackson. But it was a distinct village, about 2,000 people, with a little college, a little Baptist college. So that we had professors and for neighbors, and the culture of the Baptist church, the high school band, and the football team. That was it. That was civilization as I knew it. Also, there was no crime. We disappeared sometimes in the summer at 8 o'clock in the morning, didn't come back until 7 at night. There was no fear because the whole village took care of us.
Did you go to the Baptist church?
Oh, yes, I did. Yeah.
What was the oratory like in the church, and do you think that influenced your sense of storytelling or the way you write?
The preachers did not, but the Bible itself has. The rhythms of the Old and New Testament, in the King James Version, are just as solidly set in a person of my era who went to church as a moral foundation. I make my sentences, I'm sure, from biblical rhythms. I've been called postmodernist, but I doubt it. I think I just write in more fragmented ways and narration, but the base of my sentences, although they are sometimes baroque, is, I think, from the scriptures, as far as I can feel it myself. We read a lot of the Bible. We knew scriptures by heart, especially Psalms and a great bit of the book of John, the Sermon on the Mount and from Matthew, and certain things like that were memorized. And I had them memorized until I was 15, 16 years old.
Can you think of a line or a passage from the Bible that has the kind of rhythms that you're speaking of and how they influenced you?
Yes, it's something like the 23rd Psalm. The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow, and so on. This has just such wonderful, basic human poetry in it. And I never was sophisticated enough to consider the Bible as literature until I never even heard the term the Bible as literature until I was way into graduate school. So I'd stopped going to church, but the church is, the scriptures are very much with me, and more now. I'm reading Mark and John in the Bible. Not all the time, but I just love the clarity and the mystery at the same time.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
You bet.
Barry Hanna, recorded in July 2001. He died Monday of a heart attack at the age of 67. His work is the focus of this year's annual Oxford Conference for the Book, which began today. The conference is dedicated to him. On the heels of an acclaimed exhibition of his work at the Museum of Modern Art, Tim Burton has directed a new special effects-laden adaptation of Alice in Wonderland. In this version, Alice makes her second trip underground at the age of 19. The film stars Johnny Depp, Helena Bonham Carter, and as Alice, Mia Wasikowska, who was memorable as a troubled athlete in the first season of the HBO series In Treatment. Film critic David Edelstein has this review.
To enjoy Tim Burton's Alice in Wonderland, you'll need to accept that it's not by any stretch Lewis Carroll's Alice's Adventures in Wonderland or its follow-up, Through the Looking Glass, but a fancy Hollywood hybrid. Yes, it uses Alice's characters and motifs, but the plot is one part C.S. Lewis to one part The Wizard of Oz. You could call it C.S. Lewis Carroll's Alice in Narnia with Johnny Depp as the Mad Scarecrow. Carroll's delicious satire of English logic and manners, inspired by his enthrallment with a little blonde girl, has been turned into an action-packed feminist coming-of-age story. Alice, played by the Australian actress Mia Wasikowska, is a young Victorian woman of 19, facing the marriage proposal of an unattractive prig. She falls down a rabbit hole for the second time. The first time was when she was 6, and arrives in Wonderland, or as the locals correct her, Underland, and no one believes she's the same Alice. But if she is that Alice, a number of characters tell her, she has a destiny, to ride into battle on the Frabjous Day against the homicidally petulant Red Queen and her winged Jabberwock. If you can get past the Hollywood revisions, Alice in Wonderland is rather wonderful. Or is that underful? Burton indulges in his penchant for disproportion, so that nothing and no one in Underland quite fits, least of all our heroine, who becomes very small, then very big, then teensy enough to hide inside the Mad Hatter's hat, then vastly out of scale with the court of the Red Queen, where she's greeted as a visiting giant. As that queen, who's more like the first book's Queen of Hearts, Helena Bonham Carter sports a double-sized head atop a normal-sized body, suggesting an enormous, overdressed infant. The Queen's henchman, the Knave of Hearts, is Crispin Glover's noggin set atop a spindly, elongated frame. It's a tad disappointing when Anne Hathaway's beneficent White Queen turns out to have normal proportions, though her pallor is unearthly, and her red lips rimmed in ghoulish black. As anyone can tell you who's endured the lines in New York for the Museum of Modern Art's Burton exhibition, there are few artists who can better mix the circus and the sarcophagus, the Magic Kingdom and the mausoleum. For him, there can be no true beauty without a touch or a ton of decay. Underland is full of dead, twisted trees and giant, moldy mushrooms. The movie is in 3D in many theaters, but Burton doesn't seem interested in immersing you the way James Cameron does in Avatar. His hedges and topiary create orderly layers of space, and the foreground figures often resemble cardboard cutouts, which strikes me as exactly how it should be, given the character's playing card origins. His usual leading man, Johnny Depp, reportedly decided that the mercury poisoning that made many 19th-century hatters so mad would be evoked by his phosphorescent green eyes and Bozo the Clown orange hair, and that his skin tone and accent would shift according to his character's mood. His tea party with the Dormouse and March Hare and Cheshire Cat takes place on what looks like a bombed-out landscape.
It's you.
No, it's not. McTwist brought us the wrong Alice.
It's the wrong Alice.
You're absolutely Alice. I'd know you anywhere.
I'd know him anywhere.
Well, as you can see, we're still having tea. And it's all because I was at my special time waiting for your return. You're terribly late, you know. Naughty.
Time can be funny in dreams.
Yes, yes, of course. But now you're back, you see. And we need to get on to the Frabjous Day. I'm investigating things that begin with the letter M.
Depp's performance doesn't quite come together, but he brings an infectious zest to everything he does that makes him seem like a summer stock actor crying, "Let's put on a show." And Bonham Carter's Queen is a scream, even if it owes quite a bit to Miranda Richardson's bratty Elizabeth I in the BBC sitcom Blackadder. The fully computer-generated characters are not especially memorable. That suggests that Burton, for all his graphic genius, responds most fully to flesh-and-blood performers. He made the right call in casting Mia Wasikowska instead of a swan-necked Keira Knightley type. This Alice isn't the book's enchanting logician. But Wasikowska, as she proved on the HBO show In Treatment, can seem at one moment over-defended and the next poetically transparent. Burton, bless him, knows you can't computer-generate a soul.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. You can watch scenes from Alice in Wonderland, including a trippy tea party sequence, on our website, freshair.npr.org, where you can also download podcasts of our show.